Welcome to Nonviolent Direct Action, where we examine the societal and personal ramifications of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s insight that to passively accept an unjust system is to cooperate with that system and thereby to become a participant in its evil. I'm Jack Gilroy, host of episode number 6 in our series. Today I'll be speaking with Frank Cadaro of the Des Moines Catholic Worker. Frank Cadaro has an amazing story to tell. From high school football star to Catholic priest to jail and prison for opposing unjust laws and resisting the system of militarism. Frank knows that actions for justice speak louder than mere words. Let's meet Frank and find out what has made him the person he is today. A spokesperson for the poor, a voice for justice, a man of resistance to the powers, especially military powers, that do so much harm to our culture and people. Frank, welcome to Nonviolent Direct Action.
Thank you, Jack. What a nice introduction. Way beyond my who I really am, but thank you anyway.
Well, I don't know about that. Let me interrupt you just for a minute and say that, in scanning around the internet, going to places like Wikipedia, I see that in 1990, you became kind of a partner with some pretty big time names in the peace movement, like Dan Berrigan and Helen Caldicott and even the Dalai Lama, for God's sakes, right? You won in 1990 the Peace Abbey Courage of Conscience
Courage Award. Yeah, and Dearborn, Massachusetts, a wonderful organization and school and living situation for handicapped folks. That this is the inside information. It's my cousin's place. So as I tell him when he put my name with all the other great recipients of that Peace Award, I says, "Hey, cuz, you're doing it because I'm your cousin." He says, "Sonny," which was my nickname when we were living together and growing up in Des Moines. He says, "Whether you're my cousin or not, if I knew about you, I'd be making sure you'd get this award." So I'm really grateful for that.
Yeah.
Jack, it's hard to have kudos for any of our lives at this point. We're going to reflect on my beginning, but my beginning is much different than yours, brother. You know, the one thing that I and everyone over 60 in this country have in common is that we have lived most of our lives, almost all of our lives, in fact, all of our lives, on the ill-gotten gains of World War II, in a war that, in the end, the biggest criminals were the Allies, who chose to defeat the fascists by destroying their cities, city bombings.
Absolutely.
And I, again, I want to, I'm painfully aware that at 67, I belong to what a baby boomer generation they call us. And we are probably the single most identifiable group of people in the world that have done more damage and have done more killing in our lifetime and benefited from it than any other identifiable group of people in human history.
Wow.
I mean,
that's quite a
because
statement.
I'm living in a state, Jack, that when I was a kid, we could drink the water from my grandfather's well on a truck farm, as most people who lived in rural Iowa did. All of our water in the state of Iowa is poisoned. Can't drink clean water anywhere. The soil that's such a landmark identification about the Midwest and Iowa. In my lifetime, we lost half of it. Went down the rivers and in the Gulf and contributing to the global warming scene. And then the soil that's left is dead because we've embraced a type of agriculture that's based on an industrial model that treats the earth like a machine. And we are in a non-sustainable race to killing our ecosystem. And in Iowa, it's the soil. It's just incredible. I'm living in a state where I say we're at war all the time with the world when we're not actually fighting and killing people. In Iowa, during peacetime, we're destroying the world through our agriculture. These are big issues.
It'd be good to find out how you came to those big issues, because one time, you were a kid growing up, and I think everyone would be kind of curious about how what the evolution was of Frank Cordaro. Tell us a bit about your youth, about your family and growing up. Would you do that, please?
Sure. I was born in 1951 in Des Moines, born to George and Angela Cordaro. I was the third kid in a group of six. We're very tight and close family, and we're Italian Americans. Back then, that really meant something. My father was part of a generation. He was a second generation Italian American who fought in World War II, and in that process, his generation on the south side of Des Moines earned their citizenship. And by the time I was born and my brothers and sisters were born, we were in a part of the city called the south side of Des Moines. We belonged to St. Anthony's Parish in immigrant cultures. Their churches are very important, and that was certainly true with my family and our extended family. I lived in a unique neighborhood where within a half a block radius, there were six or seven first or second cousins, households. So I had a very clear sense of tribe and place and purpose and meaning, wrapped up with my Catholic faith. My dad was the coach, athletic director, and teacher at an all-boys Catholic high school. It was called Dowling. I was brought up in a world where I bought all of the national mythology and the nationalism of the 50s. We were in a great war against the communists. I was brought up to be aware that being Catholic and being an Italian is a problem for some people in my state of Iowa, and a real sense of coming out of a ghetto mentality, being brought up in that culture. So I was very, 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 very close to my father. I couldn't be close to any other human being. The things I remember about my dad is that when I had my first communion, I was 7 years old, my father had his first heart attack. And when most of the family and everyone was at the hospital or worried about my dad, I had a cousin take me to church so I could be part of my first communion. And I remember more than anything else, how I prayed that God would let my dad live. And God let my dad live another 10 years. And by the time he did die of his second heart attack, that was Easter Sunday morning, my senior year at Dowling High School. And the funeral they held for my father was just incredible. There was, I lost the man I idealized, and it was very difficult for me. I got a football scholarship to go to the University of Northern Iowa. I wanted to be a coach. I wanted to be just like my father.
And you were a wrestler there, too. Didn't you do some wrestling?
Oh, I wrestled there. I played football. I got my degree in physical education and health. I was well on my way to becoming a coach just like my father, except that his death left an extraordinary hole in my life. And I went to... I was excited to go to UNI because I was finally able to get away from Des Moines and what I would call my immigrant ghetto mentality, and get to a school where not everybody knew who I was and about my father. And besides, there were women who were going to school here too. And I went to an all-boys school, so it was just exciting to be on my own and to be my own person. But throughout those college years, as much fun as I had, and I had a lot of fun, I never took academics at all serious. This is a spoiler alert. I have a innate dislike for academics. I don't have a lot of respect for the smart guys, and that has continued through my life. I was convinced that no one's going to hire me to be a coach if I got a 4-point. What they wanted is people who inspired people to play ball. That's what I wanted to do with my life.
So after college, what happened?
Well, what happened is that I'm not really smart. I didn't learn any of the library skills. I passed just by going to class and writing the notes. But I did stumble into a religious experience. There was a thing called the charismatic movement back then. Some people might remember that.
I do.
In my day, that was where Catholics who had a predisposition to be a Pentecostal became Charismatics. I got into the Charismatic movement, as with some of my brothers and my mother. We really drunk the Kool-Aid. In that process, I learned to have a real personal relationship with Jesus. You know, it may sound like everybody does that now. I mean, every president even has these things. But back in the 70s, as a Catholic, you know, personal relationship with Jesus is not a language that we were comfortable with. But it fit me. And the other thing was, this is it, I got involved with scriptures. I started to read the Bible. I know I went to Catholic grade school and high school. I know I had classes in the Bible, but I'm telling you, I can't remember a damn thing. What I do remember is I picked up one of the easiest reading New Testaments, one of those big, big, big print, you know, pictures and stuff. And I read it, and I was shocked. I was stunned. I couldn't believe the words. When I read the story, I found out about this radical Jesus who, when he lived, he hung out with the poor and the disadvantaged. He himself was poor and disadvantaged. And when he lived, he had a clear moral ethic that he wanted his disciples to do, which was to live to serve others and not yourself. And if he was anything at all, he was nonviolent. And he wasn't a passive nonviolent person. He was a person who took his nonviolent love to his enemies and his opposition and spoke the truth to powers that be, his church of his day, the priest in the temple, speaking truth to them at a personal cost, and that landed him on the cross. And I look at this narrative, you know, I'm going like, wow. So Jesus's friends are all the poor and the disadvantaged and the sinners. And the people Jesus has trouble with are the rich and the powerful, people who have property and wealth. And he has direct problems with the human organizations, government, churches, educational institutions that protect the rich and the powerful and that are there for the rich and the powerful. At that time, I remember looking at all the Christian churches in this country going like, are these folks really reading this thing? Do they even understand? Do they? Because the Jesus I know in this text would not have one sympathy for the rich and the powerful problems of the rich and the powerful churches. The distance between those who claim to follow Jesus and the guy I read about was so great. That has not changed at all in my life as I progressed, as I embraced the gospel, the radical message of Jesus in college. I didn't end up marrying the cheerleader I had hoped to get married to. And I got my degree, but I wasn't ready to coach. I was probably following up on an old call to serve God as a priest. My family was always open to having one of my brothers to be a priest. I wasn't the leading candidate of the crowd. By the time I was a senior in college, I went to see Bishop Dingman, God bless him, and said to the bishop, you know, Bishop, I think maybe, you know, I'd like to study for the priesthood. And that's exactly what happened. Morris Dingman sent me to seminary, Aquinas Institute, in Dubuque with the Dominicans, mostly because he knew my family, knew my father before he died. And that's when I started my serious walk with trying to find out who this Jesus guy is and what Jesus was asking me to do.
You're listening to episode 6 of Nonviolent Direct Action. I'm host Jack Gilroy, and my guest today is Frank Cadaro of Des Moines, Iowa Catholic Worker. So how did that work out with the members of your parish? Where was your first parish, and what were some of the situations that came about when you decided that you were going to try to set an example of living a life of Jesus rather than of the institutions?
Well, by the time I got to my first parish, and that would have been 1985, I would have dropped out of seminary the first time, fell in love with Jackie Dickey, and started the Catholic Worker in Des Moines, Iowa in 1976. And in the next 7 years, fell out of love and returned to the seminary process, as I now tell people, on the rebound. And 2 years later, was ordained in 1985. Now, I was fully a known commodity then. 7 years a Catholic Worker, had already spent a couple years in jail, and I was committed to wedding my call to the priesthood with my baptismal call to resistance. And I was sent to a rural parish, Harrison County, just north of Council Bluffs in Omaha. And I spent 7 years there. That was my first 7 years. And I was a known commodity. So everybody's going like, whoa, who's this guy? And what's he going to do? And why did the bishop send him? And stuff like that. And I had a strategy about my resistance life and call and serving folks in the parish. The first thing I decided was I'm not going to ask people to do what I'm going to do. However, I am going to tell people why I do what I do. And even though the bishops, as my life processed in the priesthood, strategy was to keep me in small parishes where I can do the least damage. These small parishes afforded me a great opportunity to really be a good parish priest. I got to serve people wonderfully. I'm a pretty personal guy. I mean, the biggest surprise about active priestly ministry for me was that people really don't care about your politics. They don't care whether you're conservative or liberal. What they want to know is, are you a prayerful person? Do you take your faith seriously? And are you a decent person to them? Are you nice? Do you have people skills? They don't train you this stuff in the seminary. You know, if a guy is just nice to the people he's serving and doesn't lord over them and shows a real concern for them and their issues, which I like people. I've always liked people. It was a great job for me because you get to meet people at the critical times in their life, bring sacramental moments, wonderful stuff. The other thing is I get to preach the word every week. Bishop Dingman put me out there in Harrison County with the idea that, can you do something with the farm crisis? Well, that's what was going on in the 80s. And I started organizing around the farm crisis.
What was the farm crisis? What was that?
Back in the 80s, 1985, they called it the rural farm crisis out here, where instead of losing 2 to 3% of your farmers every year, which was in the works with the post-World War II industrial takeover of farming, where big became the only model to emulate. Sometimes these 2 to 3% a year losses went up to 10 to 15% of people on the land. And in the 80s, they over-leveraged the land base value, the value of the land bottomed out, and lots of people lost their farms. And this was a very painful time in Iowa. And I was involved with farmers who were over-leveraged. Some of them greedy, because greed is built into it. As one of the priests that trained me when I was a deacon, Father Fred Reichel, said of Iowa farmers, you know, the only thing an Iowa farmer wants is the land adjacent to his, because that's the ethic of eating each other up. And I lived with these folks. And you're not going to find better human beings than rural Iowans who care about each other and their neighbors, except in this area of land ownership. Then the ethic is the more land you have, the more successful you have. And that's the ethic that's been going on, you know, since the end of World War II. And Bishop Morris Dingman was involved in this stuff. I helped organize demonstrations and protests. We had a demonstration in a parish, Harlan, Iowa, the next town or next county over, where we had a demonstration at a farm cell, and when 21 people were arrested. So I tried to bring my radical kind of nonviolent stuff to the farm crisis, which Morris Dingman, my bishop at the time, was very much involved in. So That's what I did. And I continued my protesting at Offutt Air Force Base. The most difficult thing during that 7 years was that the war in 1990-91 happened with the U.S. Destroying
Gulf.
Saddam Hussein and all those folks in Iraq. It was awful. So I just went apoplectic, and everybody in the parish knew I would. And they were very kind to me, and let me rant and rave and do what I had to do. And then they also went to their vets' support systems and to parades in support of the war. It was a strange time to be a priest in rural Iowa and be me. And yet the trade-off with the folks in the parish is that when I'm assigned a place, I get close to people. A priest should. And then they decide whether they like you or not. And oftentimes, people liked me. Then I tell them, you know, I have to do this. This is my conscience. I have to risk being taken away from you. And I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure you have your sacramental needs met while I'm gone. But I cannot do otherwise. And I would always say to them, like, look, you don't have to have me. The bishop could send you somebody else. You just tell the bishop, really, Frank does not a good fit here. But by the time I would spend a year or two with folks, nobody wanted to do that. And they understand the Russian roulette with a new priest. You get something entirely different. And generally speaking, the people I served wanted to keep me, even if I left every other year for 6 months to do jail time, which was what was happening to me. I served 3 6-month jail times while I was a priest for trespassing at Offutt Air Force Base. That's something I started before I was a priest as a Catholic worker. So they lived with my resistance stuff. The people I served was not happy with it. They would rather not see me go to jail. Many of them believed it was just fruitless and stupid. Yet I earned respect, not for what I did as much as who I was and how I presented myself.
That's kind of interesting, Frank. What about inside of some of these prisons? What sort of relationship did you have with the inmates?
Well, you know, that's where I learned that I did some of my best priestly work there. I was a better priest. I had told people I was a better priest locked up. First of all, I prayed the office very seriously in jail. It was very formative.
Explain the office. A lot of people don't understand what the office is.
Sure. The office is a prayer that, you know, there a diocesan priest promises to pray the office daily at his diaconate. It's a morning, evening selection of psalms and texts from the scriptures and texts from the Holy Fathers that the church puts together. You're supposed to read it during the day or at the morning and night and other readings. And you promise on the same day you promise to be celibate for the rest of your life as a deacon that this is a rule of life that you would follow. Well, you know, quite honestly, didn't do much of it when I was not in jail. I really didn't warm up to the office. It's a monastic, monkish thing. However, it was a perfect prayer when you're locked up. So I was more truthful and faithful to my promise to recite the office while I was locked up. Oh, and I might add, I was much better at celibacy in jail than outside of jail. So there on those two accounts, just by institutional measurements, I was a better priest.
Did inmates come to you looking for any sort of guidance?
Well, see, that's the other thing. Once they found out I was a priest, then I became a person who was a minister in jail. I spent a lot of time one-on-one with people.
In prison ministry.
Oh, yeah. I've listened to confessions in Spanish, and I didn't even know what the sins were. I just kind of trusted God and the person's disposition and my ability to convey that there's absolution and they're forgiven.
Forgiveness, right.
Yeah.
Frank, I don't want to move on too quickly here, but for some reason, you decided to leave the priesthood. What was that all about?
Well, after 19 years, I I had a lot of difficulties with the issues, of course, the issues of church reform and the church's hypocrisy and blessing wars. I was for women's ordination before I got ordained, and while I was a priest, and I still am. I got my differences with the church, but ultimately, after spending 19 years, I had a heart attack, and I just had to come to terms with my own integrity. As I was very public about while I left because I could not get my intimacy needs met. I left because I was having relationships with women. Now, then I always have to caveat this, you know. It was legal. We were adults. There was nothing criminal going on. Isn't that terrible? We just have to do that. Except that I had to do it in secrecy. And that was destroying my integrity.
So celibacy, the key reason then turned out to be you just couldn't live as a celibate.
Couldn't live as a celibate and got tired of lying about it.
Yeah.
The lying was eroding my integrity. If you're anything, if I'm anything, my word and my life is all I got. If I lie about that, then shame on me. And that's how it came down. And I left because I wasn't getting intimacy needs met. And I was lying. I was a public liar, and I knew I needed to stop.
You're listening to Episode 6 of Nonviolent Direct Action. I'm host Jack Gilroy, and my guest today is Frank Cadaro of Des Moines, Iowa Catholic Worker. You've had a pretty close association with Reverend Billy and the Church of Shopping.
Sure.
Commercialism, right? Mm-hmm. Could you tell us a bit about that connection that you had with Billy? Reverend Billy?
Well, we got a hold of Reverend Billy as I've seen him. He's been through Iowa during the Occupy movement, and I've seen his stuff. And he's he's a street preacher, street theater type person with a choir behind him, and they do political street theater from a religious point of view, a Christian radical religious point of view. We thought he'd be an ideal person for our Occupy the World Food Prize to be a spokesperson and come and speak. And we've had him a couple times because his whole scene is the church of don't buy anything. He's going to the heart of our greed and our need for stuff and how it intertwines with consumerism and feeds the system that we have that's destroying the planet. The ism I'm talking about is Americanism. It's not a very popular ism, or it's not spoken of, but if racism can be studied and identified, if sexism can be studied and identified, and classism and consumerism, and all these things, because science gives us, we can do this, then being born in America is the single most dangerous qualification to being a human being today. There's 7 billion human beings on the planet. There's 350 million Americans. When you measure those 350 million Americans to the 7 billion people we're in a relationship with, clearly being born in America gives you a leg up in oppression and stuff and killing and all the things that empires do, we in America are doing to the rest of the world. And that makes us the most dangerous people in the world. And the most deformed.
And the institution looks upon you guys apparently as dangerous too, because you've been locked up, what, 8 times over the years?
I've been a little over 6 years cumulative, no more than a 6-month bit. No, they don't see us as dangerous. We're an anomaly that can be easily taken care of. And we are. Well, as soon as they started giving me 6 months for trespassing it off it, they knew they weren't going to stop me. But that stopped everybody else because nobody followed. Very few. There's an extraordinary thing in this American culture called risk aversion, in which the way we live our lives and integrate with each other and live in the everyday scene, we don't have time to take risk. I'm working for a social change, and I can't find 100 people who can spend a night in jail. What's that about? You know, the thing here in Iowa is that since 9/11, we have had 19,000 call-ups of our National Guard people to leave the state and go fight in the Middle East. That's 19,000 call-ups. Many of them represent one person taking one, two, or three call-ups, but at least 10,000 Iowans have actually left the state to go fight. Some of them, like close to 100, have died. Look, if you can find Iowans to go fight in bogus wars and kill people at that number, and you can't find 100 Iowans who want to spend a night in jail, we're talking about this peace movement as being just nothing but a bunch of flakes. Because nobody's real. Because no one has time to spend a night in jail. My position is, man, if you can't spend a night in jail, you really are locked in. That's just one way to look at it. The other way, though, is that we're really damaged is when we come together and we try to work collectively to do something domestic. I mean, so I'm not building a building. We're not building a rocket to the moon. We are just doing a soup kitchen here. And we can barely do it without destroying each other because we're not made well here. We are damaged property once we turn 7. And we have to recoup, have to figure out how to come out of that. And the discipline of a Catholic worker community shows the sin, no doubt about it, but it also gives the remedy, the antidote to the sin. Because the sin is the life we live here in this country, you know. It's just rich or poor, black or white, whatever it is, we are in a bad scene here. We have to learn how to live well with each other.
Well, you know, there was, I don't know if I want to call it a bad scene, but there was a fairly strong dispute among Catholic workers that was expressed in a lot of letters that you actually became kind of the moderator as I read them here some months back. And it was, the question was, you know, on nonviolent direct action and the idea of somehow or another property is disrupted or destroyed or painted on or whatever. And I noticed quite a few contrast to Kieran O'Reilly from the Australian-Irish fellow that you know. And
the Plowshares activist. Kieran's done 3 Plowshares in 3 different continents. He's quite a guy.
I'd like to get into that in a minute. But in general terms, he's very much for that sort of thing. But there were other good people within the Catholic worker who sat back and said, whoa, wait a minute. You know, I just don't accept all of that. And
Tom Cornell put out an article. And basically, on the destruction of property, was quoting Dorothy saying that the destruction of property, Plowshares folks, that's not what our people do. She said that. There's no doubt about it. She said a lot of things in their 50 years. She also went to the Plowshares and the Catonsville trials. She also remained a friend of Dan and Phil Berrigan. And she also admired their work and their Plowshares efforts and others.
Initially, Dorothy Day supported Dan Berrigan in the Catonsville 9 for burning the draft cards. But then she had some kind of a transition after that.
Right. She goes back and forth. Yeah. You know, God bless her. You know, that's good for Dorothy. The fact is that since 1980, when these Plowshares actions started, many of them have Catholic workers participating in them. All right. And we have a problem in this country. One of the things that make risking arrest so problematic is because people have property and stuff that they cannot afford to risk and give up. Because if you start resisting in this country, the first thing they come and get you is your property. So we always recommend begin at voluntary poverty, and then they have nothing to take away from you. So people hold on to their property at all risk. They won't even protest war. This culture has an obsession of property. Like property has rights like human beings. It's crazy. I've been in the legal system. I know that property and wealth has a lot more privilege and rights than human life. I mean, come on. In the legal system, we have 2 different legal systems. We got the criminal legal system and the civil legal system. Everybody knows all the money is in the civil legal system, the taxes, the real estate people. All big money is there. Little money in the criminal thing. That's just the way it is. That's a very clear indication that this culture values property over life. And that's a big obstacle. And to wrap up with the Catholic discussion, we're having discussion back and forth. Catholic workers love to discuss everything, disagree with each other. You're never going to hear people talk more than Catholic workers. The one thing you can say good about that is, beside their talk, they do the work. I'm impressed with that crowd. I may not agree with everybody, and certainly everybody don't agree with me, but we Catholic workers really are doing the work. All I can say is the most recent plowshares, the King Bay plowshares out of Georgia, was five Catholic workers and Elizabeth McAllister, Phil Berrigan's wife, and Father Steve Kelly, a Jesuit lookalike of Dan Berrigan. Man, you can't have a far more positive statement that we Catholic workers are in with the Berrigans than this most recent plowshares action. One of the Catholic workers, Martha Hennessy, is Dorothy Day's granddaughter. So I'm real excited about our Catholic worker movement and how we've wedded ourselves with the Catholic left and the Berrigans and the plowshares stuff. It's all good stuff. But I would also say it's all very pathetically inadequate, and we're nowhere close to addressing the issues we've all been trying to address for years.
Could you tell us something about your trip to Dublin this past year? And the same individual we spoke about a little while ago,
sure.
Kieran O'Reilly, what was the focus of that particular visit?
Kieran O'Reilly is a character who was here in the States in the 80s and got kicked out after he did a plowshares at the beginning of a war in Iraq in 1991. Up in Syracuse, he and a couple other friends took hammer and blood to a B-52 bomber on its way to on a bombing mission. And after 18 months of imprisonment, Kieran was deported from the United States. He was he's an Australian-Irish citizenship. And from there, he did a plowshares action in Australia and then relocated into London and Ireland and did one in Ireland. So Kieran's been on the scene for quite some time, but never been able to get back into the States. And to go see him, you have to leave the country. And I went to see him prior to this visit, 2011. So Kieran O'Reilly, his position, he says, if I'm not in personal risk right now doing something against the U.S. empire, then I'm going to support people who are risking stuff. And he's taken upon himself to be a support person for a Chelsea Manning and Julian Assange. And of course, we now know Chelsea is out of prison, thank God. Yet Julian Assange, for the last 6 years plus, had been holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, trying to avoid deportation to the United States because the English cops want to arrest him and give him over to the U.S. So he's got this asylum thing going, been there 6 years, and O'Reilly has been doing a vigil out in front of the embassy as a part of the support for Julian Assange. And when word came out that the Pope was coming to Ireland, Kieran put out the word that he was going to try an effort to get the Pope to embrace the Assange cause and give Julian Assange asylum in the Vatican. I know it's a long shot, not with this Pope if we got to him, but just a long shot to do anything like that. But, you know, you can get to Ireland, you could raise the issue. So Kieran arranged a lot of talks and stuff. I was invited to come, and I got my sidekick, Steve Jacobs. The two of us are Catholic workers. I'm from Des Moines. Steve's from Columbia, Missouri. And we went over there for 3 weeks. And when we got there, Kieran was in a very bad state personally, because couldn't seem to get any kind of mojo on his organizing. And poor Kieran was beside himself, because, you know, the Julian Assange issue difficult one at best. We have this myopic U.S. perspective that we think that maybe WikiLeaks might have helped elect Donald Trump. All that stuff is such bull. Brother, it really is. Yeah. You know, the whole concern about the WikiLeaks and their helping Trump become president is so bogus of an idea. The fact that we are going perplexed about the Russians interfering with our elections when their interference means that they're playing on our social media and stoking our phobias against each other, that's interference with our election. When, hey, I've been around the last 40 years. I've watched what we've done in Latin America. I've watched what we've done in Asia and the Middle East. We create coups. We assassinate. We control foreign elections. We name people who are going to be winners and losers. We're arrogant. And to think that someone might interfere with our elections, this is an American preposterousness, stupidity. It's the mindset of Americanism that I'm saying is so detrimental to the world.
You're listening to Episode 6 of Nonviolent Direct Action. I'm host Jack Gilroy, and my guest today is Frank Cadaro of Des Moines, Iowa Catholic Worker. Frank, in the Iowa area, we understand that the latest United States method of warfare is drone warfare, assassination of people in perhaps seven countries, perhaps more, we don't know, done by a satellite. What's going on out in the Nebraska and in Iowa area with drone warfare? And you've been involved in that. And tell us a bit more that listeners would appreciate hearing.
This is big stuff. For over 30 years, our community, Des Moines, have been going over to Omaha, Nebraska to protest at the STRATCOM, the Strategic Nuclear Command, which currently is now the command of all nuclear weapons and all of the stuff we have in space. The way we fight war now in America is connected with space by satellites who find the target and then can kill from space and assess the target through these armed drones all over the world. And these things have been coming online, can't build them fast enough. They became a problem, such a problem, a moral problem, that the U.S. Catholic bishops actually put out a statement in 2014, in January, basically condemning the Obama administration's armed drone warfare on classic Catholic teachings on human rights in the just war tradition. Obama, at that time, was killing people, innocent people. And the problem at that time, the bishop said right off the beginning, is it's not about war, it's about human rights. You can't just go and assassinate people, bad people, killers, whoever they are, without any due process. That's a problem. Never addressed. And of course, we know that they don't just kill the bad guys. They kill innocent people, too. Now, this is the Obama administration. And the way the U.S. Catholic bishops see themselves is that nowadays we negotiate with the government people, and that's how to be effective. So we wrote a statement to government people about why their armed drone command is a problem for us Catholics. Now, of course, they don't tell anybody else they're doing this. They don't bring the message home. And our bishop didn't have to because we don't have an armed drone command in 2014. But we do now. We've had them for 2 years. And we Catholic workers discovered this, and now we don't go to Omaha anymore. On August 6th and 9th, the Feast of the Holy Innocents, the Armed Forces Day, and any other days that are connected with world peace, we now go to our armed drone command to protest. Because in Des Moines, they moved this drone command. And their mission is very clear. They're to find a target on the globe, kill the target, and then assess it. It's a one-page mission, it's in public domain. So we have this actual war zone going on in Des Moines, and no one's talking about it. So we've been trying to erase the consciousness by protesting out there for the last 2 years. I've been arrested there 6 times. The most difficult thing we're having is that we can't get anybody actually to look at this thing and to name it. Willful ignorance is what's going on locally. Local pastors, bishops, they don't address the issue. No one wants to say anything about it. It's one of the strangest things I've been involved in. For all of our efforts, we can't get anybody to react. And we can't get our own bishop, who signed his own statement for all of the U.S. bishops in 2014, to say what he said in 2014 and bring that teaching to his armed drone command center in Des Moines. This is just very, very disheartening. I live in a state, Iowa, where the Des Moines Register in 2017 did a poll of Iowans and come to find out that Iowans have more faith in the U.S. military than they do in their churches. The question was, who do you put the most faith in? Now, did you hear me? White, evangelical, Trump Christians in Iowa have more faith in the military than their own churches. The third place in this poll was the police. I live in a culture where white folks have more faith in the U.S. military than they do their white churches. And then they have their third most faith in the police. This is called a fascist Christian culture. And none of the religious leaders are dealing with it. This is how I would put it with the Catholic Church. The church teaches us that there are two ways to sin at the same time. They're always happening. There's the sin of commission, which is like you go out and you do something wrong. But the greater sin is the sin of omission, which is while you're doing something wrong or whatever, what are you not doing?
Let me just ask you a question, see if you think the bishops, not only in Iowa, Nebraska, but maybe throughout the whole country, would react to the bishop in upstate New York, the Syracuse diocese. His name is Bishop Cunningham. And it was, I believe, 5 or 6 years ago that a group of us, about 5 people, were able to sit down with the bishop and ask him why, just about 2 miles away from the office where he spoke to us, the chancellery in Syracuse, was the Hancock drone base where they have admitted that Afghanistan was their prime target. So-called enemies within Afghanistan, where assassinations were taking place. And we asked the bishop, you know, what his particular moral stance was. And what he told us was that he said, number one, you have to understand that this keeps boots off the ground, which was sort of the pedestrian answer. And the second point was, do you realize that there are a lot of Catholics who work there at Hancock? Saving Americans, but killing potential enemies. And then, of course, jobs and money. How does that relate to what you see, not only among the Catholics, but among all various Christian denominations in the United States?
Okay. This fits into where I was going with the sins of omission. I know people don't want to hear this Catholic shit, but sometimes it makes a lot of sense. The sins of omission, brother, is everything we should be doing and we're not. So, did you hear that excuse your bishop gave? What about the jobs? What about it saves American lives? You know, that doesn't have a damn thing to do with the moral teachings of the church. That's never part of the discussion when you're discussing whether you have a just war or a human right violation. None of those factors are ever in the teachings of the church. We have these teachings. The bishops and their omission is that they never apply them. the bishops in their omission live in Iowa. I'm living in a functioning fascist Christian culture. That's because the bishops have never addressed the bigger issues, which are the mantra of American Christendom is pro-rich, pro-war, pro-USA. That is what we do affirmatively all the time as Christians, especially Christians that have wealth and property. The Catholics are one of them. Because we live our institutions by the rules of wealth and property, and the automatic mantra is pro-rich, pro-war, pro-USA. Those are the larger neglected sins. The more ones of commission right now are the dreadful, ugly sexual sins of our bishops and our priests. Ugly. Can't say nice things about that. But dear friends, it pales to the ignorance of the whole of Christendom in the U.S. as we go our merry way killing people and thinking we're doing God's work. Now that's the problem.
You say you're a Christian anarchist, though Catholic workers refer to themselves as Christian anarchists. How does that fit in with the political scene today?
Well, it's the only way to be. I mean, I'm not a philosophical anarchist. Like, I don't think any government can be good. Yeah, I don't even have to say that. I don't have to have that kind of blanket statement. I've been around 67 years. I can say quite simply, every government I've known in my lifetime doesn't hit the mark. I'm an anarchist by default. I'm a functioning anarchist because I ain't seen nothing that reflects the kingdom.
This upcoming election, Frank, this is the fall of 2018, and we're only a couple of weeks away from the election. Do you think the election will anything occur that will absolutely or possibly change the system that we have now?
Absolutely no. I'm watching the soap opera out of Washington. I can't stand Trump. God, he's an ugly man. Look. Any story that has the FBI coming out as the heroes is a problem for me. Because I know what the legal system is like. So when we have to look to the FBI to save us from our president, we're just talking about the difference between a fox and a wolf. Okay, I'm used to that. However, I don't want to minimize Trump's presidency. This man is so ugly. It's awful. The only good thing, as a person who believes in being honest, because really honesty is really important for me, I stake a lot of my integrity on it. The good thing I can say about Trump is he's at least we finally have a president who reflects the true nature of our ugly American presence. Because we got a very ugly president who fits the bill and reflects who we've been to the world. And if we don't like it, well, it's about time. This is exactly who we've been to the world.
So where do we go from this? I mean, as we wrap up this session, where is there any hope out there? Do you see any changes around the horizon with the younger generation? Or is there some possibility that in another 4 or 10 or 20 years, maybe things could be turned around, including the environment?
I'm kind of really painfully remembered that at the end of Dorothy Day's life, someone asked something to the effect, well, was it worth it? Did you think you accomplished anything? And she really just said, I just think things are worse now than they were when we started. Okay, hear that.
Yeah.
Hear this about my great uncles. In the 60s, when we were growing up, they all thought the world was coming to an end. They thought the country was going to hell. All the drugs, the sex, no one obeys anything, no one has any respect. And we looked at our uncles and said, we got this. Don't worry about it. Well, now I'm as old as my great uncles. I look at the world. it's a hell of a lot worse than it was when we started. I think my great uncles were right, too. On the other hand, maybe I'm just an old guy acting like a great uncle. I don't know. This I do know. My whole life has been about integrity and speaking truth. I did that personally as a priest, struggling with my human sexuality, my intimacy needs, and my integrity. I got a heart attack from a lie. I want to live, speak the truth. That's very important to me. It's my life narrative. I think it's also what this country lacks a great deal of. Truth. Seeing things as they really are. Measuring things at their true measure. And from where I'm at, this is not a positive picture. However, the most positive thing I can say about looking at it and naming it is we're never going to do anything about it if we don't own up to the truth. So, in a backhanded way, I find hope in speaking truth that's not all that hopeful, simply because integrity is the place to start. Eyes wide open to the truth, so that the first step will put us in the right direction. Now, the other thing is that I also find hope and truth in the people I serve. And I guess if I were to tell you where I actually feel the hope and truth the most is with the people we serve and those little things. We really are supposed to believe that we're serving Jesus every time we're giving someone a bowl of soup. If that be true, then that's where our hope is. That's where we should invest it. I don't always feel hopeful, but I know deep down I live a hopeful life because I'm willing to act and do the works of mercy and speak the truth.
Frank, it's really truly an honor to be able to ask you a few questions and learn so much in just a period of about an hour. Appreciate it, and we'll be talking to you again for sure. You've been listening to episode 6 of Nonviolent Direct Action. I'm host Jack Gilroy, and my guest has been Frank Cordaro of the Des Moines Catholic Worker. You can find this episode and the entire Nonviolent Direct Action series on iTunes. You can find related links on our blog, nonviolentdirectaction.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening.